So my name is Freddie Helmer, if I haven't met any of you, and this is our third session in a very loosely organized series that is roughly around environmentalism and Christianity. So on day one, we talked about wilderness, that whole concept, what is and isn't wilderness. Yesterday, we talked about can you be a Christian and an environmentalist at the same time, and both the promising and the troubling parts of Christianity for the environment. And today we're going to kind of bring it home, bring it into our own home and our own lives, and think through stuff. We're going to think about materialism and the stuff in our lives. And I hope this will actually be quite fun and interesting. So to start, I want to do a simple and brief exercise. So you all have a clipboard and a pen. And I would like you all to choose a small place in your homes, such as, for example, a small room in your house, or maybe if you own a vehicle, your car, or if you carry around a purse, that kind of thing. And I want you to list from memory everything that you can remember that's in that space. So everything that is currently in your car, everything that's currently in your purse or backpack, everything that's in your room here, or a closet perhaps, keep it kind of small and manageable. And it's okay if you can't think of everything. The idea is to attempt to recall all of the possessions in that space. All right, wherever you are, bring it to a close. So you don't have to share your list, but does anyone have any reactions that came out of this brief exercise you'd like to share?
I guess I ended up thinking back to my school backpack before I was at Holden, because I was kind of realizing that I actually don't really have very much stuff here since I'm only here for a couple months. Uh-huh. And so there wasn't really any specific space that holds more than like a couple things and clothes.
Yeah.
So, but thinking back to like being in school, I have a lot of stuff.
Yeah. Not the ideal exercise for a remote mountain village where people by necessity can't really have a lot of belongings. But the idea is, this is not obviously not to instill guilt, but it's simply to bring awareness. Probably when we don't live at Holden, we have more stuff than we do here. And we probably have more stuff than most people in the world, and we probably have more stuff than we need, although there may be exceptions to that. Americans probably own the most stuff of any people, of any nation in the world, and it was not always this way. In fact, one interesting way to think about the transition from the 17th to the 18th century, so from the 1600s to the 1700s, is that a sort of middle-class individual or family, a family of moderate means in the 17th century, could list everything that they owned without much difficulty. It might take a little while, but they could list it all. They might say, an individual might say, I have 3 trousers and 4 shirts, and I have 2 pairs of shoes and 5 spoons and 5 plates, and I have, they could list it all. The transition into the 18th century changed all of that, and a moderate, sort of middle-class individual or family was usually no longer able to list out those things. And so now even kind of picking like one small part of our lives can sometimes be quite an exercise to recall all of the things that we own. So what we're going to do today is kind of dive a little bit into the story behind our stuff. And I wanted to introduce 4 different kinds of different ways of thinking about stuff, about materialism in our lives. So, can everyone see the board?
Yes.
I'm going to show a video in a moment. And there's a, well, I'll get to there in just a minute. So, Americans own an awful lot of stuff. And it's what is important, I believe, is to think about the story behind the stuff in our lives. So everything that comes into our life has a backstory. Eventually it started somewhere in the world, usually as resources spread all throughout the world, that were extracted, and they were brought together. So this is the first part, this is the extraction part. So minerals, resources, are mined, extracted, brought together into a production facility where they are manufactured into some kind of a good. So the input here would be not just the stuff of the earth, but also some labor, some capital, and there's and then out of this comes a thing, a widget, some kind of thing that ends up in a store, and it is bought in that store by an individual usually, and then ends up being used in their home, in the personal life, or in a company or something like that, and then it ends up in the dump or in the incinerator. And this is the sort of the line of production. There's a couple of things to note about this line. The first is that there's a lot of things that exit this production line along the way. So here, there's a lot of sort of destruction of the trees and of the mountains and of the animals in the process of extracting the resources. Here in the production area, there's a whole lot of pollution that ends up getting put into our air and our soil and our water. Here in the store, there is a lot of, there's people all along this entire production line. This is sort of what's called the golden triangle. This is the consumption, the golden arrow. This is sort of the consumption, and this is what most of media and advertising focuses on. And a lot of the media and advertising would like you to forget everything that comes on this end, and it would also like you to forget what happens after this thing exits our lives. But these things also have a future story, right? I have an iPod. One day, I won't use that iPod anymore. It will break, or it will somehow, I won't be able to use it in my life, I won't want it, and it will leave my life. And there's a couple different options. You know, I can try to extend it as long as I can, I can try to repair it, I can try to donate it to someone else, but eventually it will just be broken, and it will have to leave my life. And then somehow it's going to have a final journey, and it will end up somewhere, and it will be broken apart, and then the parts of that iPod are eventually going to re-enter the soil and the air and the water and people's bodies, usually in a way that's not very nourishing and life-giving to them. So this obviously is a line, and what that means it's not is a circle. In nature's economy, there is no waste. Waste is food. In our economy, there's a whole lot of inputs and there's a whole lot of waste. This is not a closed loop. For a really wonderful illustration of this, I recommend Annie Leonard's online video, The Story of Stuff. We're going to watch a video she made called The Story of Electronics, which is a much shorter and more specific version of her story of stuff. But the 20-minute long video is very amusing, entertaining, informative, so I recommend.
What's her name again?
Annie Leonard. L-E-O-N-A-R-D. And were you saying that there's a book in the bookstore?
Yeah, I think I do believe so. I saw the book that looks very much like the, this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think she did her whole PhD on stuff, where it comes from, where it goes, and then she wanted to make it really accessible to a public audience, so she made these entertaining videos. So I became quite interested in this end of things, this sort of trash end of things. So I taught a course at UW and it was all about trash. And I want to share a couple little things from that class. Americans produced really not very much trash before the 20th century. One thing I would have my students do would be to interview an elder, someone who was 60, 70 years old or older, a grandparent, someone that they know, and ask them what trash was like when they were a child. What constituted trash? Where would it go? And there were some really interesting stories. I mean, for the most part, trash was very different then than it is now, and there was a whole lot less of it. For the most part, manufacturers, kind of pre-World War II, sold things in bulk without a whole lot of packaging, and people reused things quite a lot. So for example, food scraps might go to animals, to pigs or to chickens, or they might be boiled down into some kind of a broth, or they might somehow be reused until they were truly not edible anymore. Durable items would get passed along to someone else or stored for another time. If an item had no use for adults, it would often be a toy for children. If something was broken or worn out, it would be fixed, and there was knowledge about how to fix and repair things. That knowledge is quickly seems to be draining from our society. I had a little digital camera in grad school that stopped working, and I spent hours and hours looking online for someone who could repair it. I was sure it was repairable. It wasn't that complicated. And I finally found one place, and the cost of repairing it was exorbitant. And I remember mentioning this to my eco justice professor in class, kind of offhand, and she's like, "Oh, you can just get those at Target for like $50 these days. There's no." And I was like, "Oh, you're my eco justice professor. You're supposed to be the one who's telling me to like do whatever I can to extend the life of this material." But the mentality really is, it's just so much easier to buy a new one than to try and repair. If something is beyond repair, it was usually dismantled and the parts would be sold or reused or reclaimed in some way. If there's absolutely no other use, something was often burned for heat or for cooking. So imagine the life experience of a piece of white cotton fabric, say 100 or 150 years ago. It might start out as a bedsheet. It's nice and big and clean and new and white. And then eventually as it gets worn down, it might get cut up and put into a shirt for someone to wear. And as that gets more and more worn down, it might become a dish towel. And then after its life is done as a dish towel, it might be a sanitary napkin. And then after that, it might turn into a rag of some kind. And then finally, it might finish its life as paper. It might get converted into a sheet of paper. So really this long, long lifespan of a simple thing. So the change came about for a number of reasons, but by and large, this was a post-World War II change. And there was enormous opportunity for corporate profit from having people believe that they needed more things in their lives and making those things not very durable and not last very long. And so there's a whole industry that got built up around this to make people feel as though there was a scarcity in their lives, that they needed more stuff, that stuff came in more packaging. All of this resulted in a lot more trash being produced. And that's kind of the world we live in now. Today, for every single ton of municipal solid waste, so for every ton of trash, there are 70 tons of waste produced to create those items that end up in the trash. So basically, for every one ton here, all along this line, 70 tons of trash are produced to make that. And that is all industrial, mining, manufacturing, petrochemical, and agricultural waste. So I'm going to jump now to this video. It's quite short. It's about 6 minutes long. And again, it's not the true big picture story of stuff. She's just looking at electronics here, which I find really quite interesting. And so she's going to tell a little bit of this story. So let's see. I have to plug this back in.
This is a story about a world obsessed with stuff. It's a story about a system in crisis. We're trashing the planet, we're trashing each other, and we're not even having fun. The good thing is that when we start to understand the system, we start to see lots of places to step in and turn these problems into solutions. Find my computer charger. My computer is my lifeline to my work, my friends, my music. So I looked everywhere, even in that drawer where this lives. I know you have one too. A tangle of old chargers, the sad remains of electronics past. How did I end up with so many of these things? It's not like I'm always after the latest gadget. My old devices broke or became so obsolete I couldn't use them anymore. And not one of these old chargers fits my computer. Ah, this isn't just bad luck. It's bad design. I call it design for the dump. Design for the dump sounds crazy, right? But when you're trying to sell lots of stuff, it makes perfect sense. It's a key strategy of the companies that make our electronics. In fact, it's a key part of our whole unsustainable materials economy. Design for the dump means making stuff to be thrown away quickly. Today's electronics are hard to upgrade, easy to break, and impractical to repair. My DVD player broke, and I took it to a shop to get fixed. The repair guy wanted $50 just to look at it. A new one at Target cost $39. In the 1960s, Gordon Moore, the giant brain who invented the semiconductor, predicted that electronics designers could double processor speed every 18 months. So far, he's been right. This is called Moore's Law. But somehow, the bosses of these genius designers got it all twisted up. They seem to think that Moore's Law means every 18 months we have to throw our old electronics and buy more. Problem is, the 18 months that we use these things are just a blip in their entire life cycle. And that's where these dumb designers aren't just causing a pain in our wallets, they're causing a global toxic emergency. You see, electronics start where most stuff starts, in mines and factories. Many of our gadgets are made from 1,000 different materials, shipped from around the world to assembly plants. There, workers turn them into products using loads of toxic chemicals, like PVC, mercury, solvents, and flame retardants. Today, this usually happens in far-off places that are hard to monitor, but it used to happen near my home in Silicon Valley, which, thanks to the electronics industry, is one of the most poisoned communities in the U.S. IBM's own data revealed that its workers making computer chips had 40% more miscarriages and were significantly more likely to die from blood, brain, and kidney cancer. The same thing is starting to happen all around the world. It turns out the high-tech industry isn't as clean as its image. So, after its toxic trip around the globe, it lands in my hands. I love it for a year or so, and then it starts drifting further from its place of honor on my desk or in my pocket. Maybe it spends a little time in my garage before being tossed out. And that brings us to disposal, which we think of as the end of its life. But really, it's just moved on to become part of the mountains of e-waste we make every year. Remember how these devices were packed with toxic chemicals? Well, there's a simple rule of production. Toxics in, toxics out. Computers, cell phones, TVs, all this stuff is just waiting to release all their toxics when we throw them away. Some of them are slowly releasing this stuff even while we're using them. You know those fat old TVs that people are chucking for high-def flat screens? They each have about 5 pounds of lead in them. Lead, as in lead poisoning. So, almost all of this e-waste either goes from my garage to a landfill or gets shipped overseas to the garage workshop of some guy in Guiyu, China, whose job it is to recycle it. I've visited a bunch of these so-called recycling operations. Workers without protective gear sit on the ground, smashing open electronics to recover the valuable metals inside and chucking or burning the parts that no one will pay them for. So while I'm on to my next gadget, my last gadget is off poisoning families in Guiyu or India or Nigeria. 6 billion tons of e-waste have been dumped, burned, or recycled. And most recycling is anything but green. So are the geniuses who designed these electronics actually evil geniuses? I don't think so, because the problems they're creating are well hidden even from them. You see, the companies they work for keep these human and environmental costs out of sight and off their accounting books. It's all about externalizing the true cost of production. Instead of companies paying to make their facilities safe, the workers pay with their health. Instead of them paying to redesign using fewer toxics, villagers pay by losing their clean drinking water. Externalizing costs allow companies to keep designing for the dump. They get the profits and everyone else pays. When we go along with it, it's like we're looking at this toxic mess and saying to companies, you made it, but we'll deal with it. I've got a better idea. How about you made it, you deal with it? Doesn't that make more sense? Imagine that instead of all this toxic e-waste piling up in our garages or on the streets of Guiyu, we sent it to the garages of the CEOs who made it. You can bet that they'd be on the phone to their designers pretty fast demanding they stop designing for the dump. Making companies deal with their e-waste is called extended producer responsibility, or product take-back. If all these old gadgets were their problem, it would be cheaper for them to just design them longer-lasting, less toxic, and more recyclable in the first place. They could even make them modular so that when one part broke, they could just send us a new piece instead of taking back the whole broken mess. Already, take-back laws are popping up all over Europe and Asia. In the U.S., many cities and states are passing similar laws. These laws need to be protected and strengthened. It's time to get these brainiacs on our side. With take-back laws and citizen action to demand greener products, we can start a race to the top, where designers compete to make long-lasting, toxic-free products. So let's have a green Moore's law. How about the use of toxic chemicals will be cut in half in the 18 months? The number of workers poisoned will decline at an even faster rate. We need to give these designers a challenge they can rise to and do what they do best, innovate. Already, some of them are realizing they're too smart to be dump designers and are figuring out how to make computers without PVC or toxic flame retardants. Good job, guys. But we can do even more. When we take our e-waste to recyclers, we can make sure they don't export it to developing countries. And when we do need to buy new gadgets, we can choose greener products. But the truth is, we are never going to just shop our way out of this problem. because the choices available to us at the store are limited by the choices of designers and policymakers outside of the store. That's why we need to join with others to demand stronger laws on toxic chemicals and on banning e-waste exports. There are billions of people out there who want access to the incredible web of information and entertainment that electronics offer. But it's the access they want, not all the toxic garbage. So let's get our brains working on sending that old design for the dump mentality to the dump where it belongs, and instead, building an electronics industry and a global society that's designed to last.
So again, this is specific to electronics. She's got a whole series of these, and the classic beginning one is called The Story of Stuff. It kind of starts from the beginning, but are there any reactions, comments to the video?
I guess I would question, when you're getting rid of that stuff, how do you find out what they're doing with it? Like, we just got rid of a couple CDs. We took them to Goodwill because they said they'd be recycling them. I had no idea to find out if they were sending them overseas.
Yeah, yeah.
So how do we find that out?
Yeah, it's really hard, isn't it? Because it's really hard. And you know, if you brought it to Goodwill because it was still functioning and someone else could use it, that's great because it prolongs its life. But eventually, right? Eventually, that will break down and it has to go somewhere. I think that most electronics in America, if it's said that they are recycled, they end up in China, or they end up in like two or three places in Africa. I think it's Uganda and Nigeria and somewhere else. And for the most part, these are workers, like the video showed, that are trying to reclaim the metals that are valuable that could be reused. But a lot of that can't, like especially the plastics that encase it, like the glass of the computer screen. And then, like they said, simply the process of extracting that releases all of these toxins. So it's kind of about going back to the source. So like she's saying, either redesigning these things or, you know, not bringing them into our lives in the first place. Any other thoughts or comments?
So it talks about companies designing to last. Are there companies that are doing that?
Yeah, I think more and more, maybe not out of the goodness of their heart, but because I think there's consumer pressure now to have products that last longer and are greener. So one, I don't know specifically about electronics, but in general for shopping, there's one really excellent resource called the Better World Shopping Guide. And it's by a man named Ellis Jones. It's a small booklet. It's small enough to fit in a pocket or in a purse. And this guy basically organized most of the common things you might buy on a shopping trip by category. So you flip through the book and you have, you have food, you have cosmetics, you have auto parts, you have, beer, you have all of these different categories. And he ranks all of the companies that produce those items and gives them a grade from A to F. And it's based on five criteria: the way they treat their workers, their impact on the environment, testing on animals, their social impact, and I can't remember the fifth one. But he kind of goes into detail about how he gets these rankings,
His name again?
Ellis Jones, E-L-L-I-S Jones, and it's the Better World Shopping Guide, and he comes up with a new edition every 2 years or so because these things change. So we just got a Costco membership, and when I'm walking through Costco, I don't have a lot of money, I want to get cheap toilet paper, right? But I have a lot of options. There's at least four or five different brands. So instead of just, you know, grabbing the one that's cheapest, I'll open up the book to toilet paper and I'll see all of the, so Charmin gets like a C maybe, and Bounty maybe gets like a D. Oh, but then there's this one company that gets a B+, so I'll just grab that toilet paper because this book tells me the backstory that I just don't know. So that's one way to go about it. Does anyone know of any other ways to know about the ethics?
Yeah. So I was shopping for hiking gear last spring, and just looking for, kind of also concerned about this, like, you know, searching around a little bit, and we were moving, and looked up Goodwill, and their recycling policies, and then learned from some blogs that most of their recycled clothes, a lot of them, if they don't, can't be reused or resold to like rag makers, and it goes, and they end up going to Africa. And then, they get resold there and, or often end up in dumps there. But I was looking at some hiking gear along with clothes and researching different sites, and a lot of sites have like under, you know, at the bottom, like fine print, you know, all the options, like there's usually one like about us or corporate information or company information, that kind of stuff. A lot of them do have kind of at least like hiking gear companies, I'm sure others have too, but there's a social responsibility part or like corporate responsibility, that kind of thing, and that usually takes you to what they're trying to do with their employees, with their suppliers. A lot of companies, at least from where I looked at, are signed up for the, I forget what it was called, it's a program that internationally that tries to monitor supplier factories and the working conditions there, and kind of, again, you know, gives them a grade. There's also different chemical groups. There's, I think it's Blue Sign or something like that. It's kind of a group that some companies belong to that they're trying to make products that are don't have toxic chemicals, and they actually go through and like test each chemical in the product, and it has to meet certain criteria. And, Patagonia is one that has done pretty darn well on that, and they've actually started, Patagonia and one other that I was looking at for hiking gear actually started to accept their own clothing back, and they have some products that are actually made from recycled synthetic materials, which you just, it's really hard to find anything, anybody that does that.
Mm. Yeah. So, in the time we have remaining, I think what I'd like to do, I want to jump over to, what should we do? Let's briefly go over these. Could I get a volunteer to read? These are two very short verses from Luke about stuff, and then I'm going to share a haiku. Does anyone have access to a Bible? It looks like we've got one.
I've got 12, 33, 34.
Great, thank you. And could I get someone to do the first one, 3, 11 through 12?
Yeah.
Thank you.
That Lisa's looking it up.
Who gets it first? Who gets it first?
Thank you.
So more stuff's ending up in the landfill, and we're buying more stuff, and there's more plastic and all that going to the landfills post-World War II. And I don't know how it was necessarily in the cities prior to that, but in the county and the rural areas, that stuff, I mean, there wasn't as much stuff, but that stuff was burned on fence lines, and it's just bottles and dirt and tin cans and stuff, and farmers with pits. So that's, we don't know what was not making it to a landfill before, because that's the way those things were dealt with.
Yeah, where we live, a lot of people just dump their own garbage in their own landfill.
If you want to kind of look for something, you'd look at old fence lines or go dig an old outhouse, and there'll be bottles and all sorts of things in there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was definitely nastier stuff in the landfill now, no way around it, but I mean, the poundage going here and poundage going there, I don't know how good those numbers or what, how much they really think that means. I mean, there's lots of pounds in a glass bottle that is just
sure, but that glass bottle probably had a longer life before it was disposed of.
Yeah, but either way, I'm just saying it ended up buried in a fence line.
Sure, yeah. So pretty much all trash, you know, throughout history has either been buried or burned, and then more recently or dumped in the ocean. Those are kind of the three places that it ends up. So I think that the trend we are noticing, and very recently, say the last two generations, is a whole lot more stuff, a whole lot more plastic, which kind of entered the world relatively recently, and a whole lot more toxins, and toxins that react with one another in ways that we can't quite anticipate, so a lot more funky gunk out there than there ever was before. But yeah, you're right. So,
I mean, it's a lot better that it's going to the dump and they're burning it on fence lines. I guess that they don't bust a computer and burn it in the backyard. Mm-hmm. Where the old paint cans and everything else just got buried, you know, burned in the pit, and then the pit got dug next to it.
Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. We got those verses?
Yeah. He answered and said unto them, He that has two coats, let him impart to him that has none. And he who has meat, let him do likewise. Then came also publicans to be baptized, and said unto him, Master, what shall we do?
Thank you. And the other one, sell your possessions and give alms. Make purses for yourselves that do not wear out, an unfailing treasure in heaven, where no thief comes near and no one destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also.
Thank you. So two kind of brief kind of takes on the stuff in our lives and the attitude to have towards it. And I want to share a haiku from a famous Japanese poet named Ryokan, who was, I think he was a 12th century poet. And he lived a very, very simple life. He was kind of a hermit, so he had like a hut and he had like a bowl and a stick and, you know, very, very basic possessions. But he went out one day and a thief came in and stole what he had, like the few items that he had. And he came back to his hut and he wrote a haiku. So this will be the translation. It won't be 5-7-5 in English, but the haiku basically is, the thief, he forgot it, the moon at my window. So just a couple kind of brief takes on materialism. If you have two coats, give one away. You only need one. Make things to last. Where your treasure is, that's where your heart will be as well. You'll find treasure in heaven. And then sort of this disregard of the stuff itself, because it is the intangible things that truly matter. And these are three sources of a couple different ways of thinking about materialism. So I just want to mention something about each of these. These are different kind of value stances to have about stuff in our lives. So transmaterialism basically is, who cares? Don't worry about stuff. The birds of the air, the lilies of the field, they don't care about the stuff. Don't find value in your stuff. This is very commonly found in a lot of Eastern religions. So it's sort of anti-stuff. Don't care very much about it. That is one perspective to take. The second, which is anti-materialism, would be a little bit more ascetic. So this is living in a very consciously anti-materialism simple way. This would be John the Baptist and his coat of camel hair and eating locusts. A lot of the desert mothers and fathers. So much more of a focus on the spirit. And it's very dualistic. So the spirit is good and matter is bad. It's actively a sort of a negative thing that you want to avoid or minimize in your life. The third one is called deep materialism. And this is basically having a stance of responsibility or stewardship. So if you're going to go out and buy a coat, you might save your money, you might do your research, you might look in the Better World Shopping Guide on the websites, and you're going to buy a coat that is durable, it's going to last, it's the kind of style that's sort of classic, so in 10 years it won't have gone out of style and you can still wear it. When it wears down, you're going to very carefully mend and repair it. You're going to sort of cherish this coat and really appreciate it so that it's not one of, you know, seven coats we have in our closet. I don't really care, and if I lose one, then it's no big deal. But you begin to really kind of value the few items you have and deeply respect and love them so that you're honoring, you know, this whole path that brought it into your life. And we find a lot of this, kind of hints of this in the Proverbs, I think. And then finally, spiritual materialism recognizes the holiness of all things. This is the idea that, you know, Christ came down to earth and was incarnate on this earth. God is with us at all times and even in things. So you see something holy in the stuff in our lives and in the stuff all around us. So there's certainly some overlap, but also kind of four different ways to approach stuff in our lives. And I want to ask you all which of these four resonates with you, if any.
I think for us, because we're not stuff people, deep materialism limited by extreme poverty. So, you know, sometimes you have an ideal in your mind that you would like to live by, but then your actual circumstances often limit what your ideal is. So we actually currently kind of live by almost from the secondhand store back to the secondhand store kind of way of doing things. And we like to, the advantage of that is being able to find really high quality items that we wouldn't normally be able to purchase from a regular store. So like he wants a really nice wool coat, so we'll wait for it for until we can find one in the secondhand store.
Mm-hmm.
And so we try to avoid ideals right now because it just makes life harder. But would you say that when we fit into most? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But without worrying about it so much that it takes away from, like in life you have priorities. So when you have real life problems, if we were to spend too much time doing this when we have these other really extreme issues going on, it would seem unwise. You know what I mean? So we just try to keep it a little bit balanced. I mean, there's definitely the times when we just go out and grab something real quick.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our ideal, but...
Yeah, and I think this deep materialism is also practiced plenty here at Holden. I can also kind of by necessity, but it's sort of beautiful to come in and see a blanket on the bed that's been very carefully, you know, mended so that the frayed edge now has a different piece of fabric over its extending its life, or the screen outside our window that has clearly been, you know, repaired. And it might not be like perfect, right, by like conventional standards out there, but it's been lovingly mended, and its life has been prolonged. And I really love being in a place where you see that all around. In our safety meeting, is it Peter? Peter's the safety guy. He was like, you know, at a place like Holden, everyone wants to like repair the broken ladder, but you can't repair the broken ladder. It's broken. It's not safe anymore. But that there is this mentality of like, yes, indeed, let's extend the life of things as long as possible. Anyone else resonate with any of these other options? I can repeat what it is if you'd like.
I don't remember which one it fits under, but for me and our lifestyle, it's always been to buy quality and then just keep repairing it and not buy more than we need. I do not have a clothes full of closet. I mean, there's plenty of clothes in the closet, but not like people who have 6 coats or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But to fix it, and an example would be when our kids were little and they had bikes, we bought secondhand bikes. Mm-hmm. And we fixed them, and their cousins went through 3 or 4 bikes in the same amount of time that our kids had one.
Yeah.
So I think, I don't remember which one that fits under, but that's the one that makes sense to me.
Yeah, I think that's also deep materialism.
Yeah.
Or kind of conscientious materialism. A sort of an interesting thought exercise that we did this in a little group in our church was we read this this verse about if anyone has 2 coats, you should give one away. And we had this really critical discussion of what counts as 2. We can start with coats, right? I have more than 1 coat, but I could argue, well, one is a raincoat and one is like a heavy down coat, and those aren't interchangeable. And then if I'm going out somewhere nice, I have sort of a nice coat. So I have 3 coats. Am I supposed to give 2 away and just find, you know, the one that's most functional? You know, if I have more than 1 pair of shoes, am I supposed to give those away? Where do we draw the line, right? When is it enough? And when does it become too much? So that's kind of an interesting thought exercise to go down. And maybe what I'll do is, if anyone wants to linger, we're kind of out of time, and explore that, we can sit here and chat about it. But I want to finish by guiding us through a brief exercise in deep materialism. So I'd like you all to pick something that is on your body right now. Some article of clothing, it could be shoes, socks, shirt, whatever it is, glasses, jewelry, something that is on your body. And think about where it came from. When did this item enter your life? Do you remember where you bought it from, or who gave it to you, or where you first acquired it? And then think back on how long it's been in your life. Think about maybe some experience that you have had wearing this item, this article of clothing, or this accessory. And recall that that was part of you, part of your body when you went through that life experience. And now take a moment to really examine it either look at it or notice the feeling of it against your skin. How does it feel on your body? How much does it weigh? What is its texture? How does it feel? What color is it? What kind of fabric or material is it made from? Look at the stitching or feel how it's put together. Are there any places where it's worn or torn or dirty? Are there places where it's been mended or frayed? Is there a story behind the place where you see wear and tear and use on this thing? And imagine yourself having some kind of future experience with this item in your life. Imagine some event you might go to, or adventure you might have, or just life experience you might have in a week or a month or a year with this thing still in your life, on your body. And then imagine some way in which when it leaves your life, it might leave it responsibly. Whatever that might mean for this particular item. So with that, I thank you all for being here today. And if anyone wants to linger around and chat more, I'm happy to do so. But otherwise, go forth with mindfulness about stuff in your lives. Thank you.